Our first speaker is David Marquette. He's going to talk about how document space is like an elephant.
Thank you. So I picked this title for three reasons. First, I wanted to have the most cutesy title in the thing. And somebody pointed out that perhaps it's not the most cutesy title, and there is one coming up this afternoon that some people have said is even better. And that makes me a little upset.
The best was the last talk of the morning with Peter. That was a great night.
Yeah,
that was a great night. So, and another reason is that there's a couple of points I want to get across, and obviously this has to do with the blind man and the elephant, and so there's actually a method to the madness. And the third reason is that when Carrie started talking to me about this, I started wondering what document space could possibly mean. And I thought about it for so long that I'm starting to think maybe it is like an elephant. So, which just goes to show you that I get quite a bit too much caffeine. Okay, so I'm going to talk about what document space is, or try to come up with some ideas of how to think about document space. So I'm not going to tell you about my particular algorithm or a particular subproblem, although I think it's very, very important to think about those, because those are how we understand document space should be. And I think that, you know, we've had some very good talks in this that have helped, they've helped me think more about what one might mean by document space. But I decided I would try to answer the question, and I'm not going to succeed, but we'll see what we can do. And I'm going to take a pattern recognition sort of data mining perspective to this. When Carrie first told me we're going to have this document space thing, to me, document space was the space into which you should embed documents so that you can analyze them. And so that's where I came at the problem. There's other ways you can think about it. We saw various kinds of probabilistic models, language models, these generative models, and you can think about those model spaces as document space, and I think that's a perfectly legitimate thing to think about. And I think I don't think there is a document space interpretation. I think there are many different ways we can think about what one might mean by such a thing. But my bias was to sort of think about it as something to do with how you map documents into something. And it's this. My first thought was it's the something we should understand. Where should we put these documents? So I put Euclidean, d-dimensional Euclidean space there. There's lots of arguments as to why that's perhaps not the best thing, but I'm going to argue that sort of from the perspective of Peter's talk is that it doesn't matter. That is, there are methods wherever we initially put these documents to put them into Euclidean space. So we might as well think about them as going into Euclidean space. Now I'm starting to think that it's not a mapping, it is a space of mappings. And so I'll talk very, very briefly about what I might mean there. So my outline is, I'll talk about pattern recognition. We'll mention the blind man and the elephant story. There's a thing called corpus-dependent feature extraction, which I want to talk about, and something about conditionings, and then we'll get back to the elephants. So pattern recognition. What are the steps of pattern recognition in my view? How does one do pattern recognition? Well, what you do is you extract features from a signal, or you measure an object, you get measurements. Often, and I would say usually, this is done somewhat ad hoc. You collect a bunch of things that you know how to measure. And you measure as many things as you have time to measure that you think makes sense to measure. If you're really going to do it right, you need an expert in the field. If you're going to do document analysis, if you're going to write a new query, new search engine, you really need to have somebody who knows something about the field. I'm going to talk about that some more. And exactly what features you extract depend on the problem, on what it is you're going to do with those features once you get them. Then you select out the features from that set that you think are good and you project them into some space, and this is almost always some d-dimensional Euclidean space. Then you build the algorithm that's going to take these features and give you the answer you want. It's going to do something with them. And that's usually classification, regression, clustering, or something like that if you're a statistician. And that involves choosing a model, and there's all kinds of things that go into there. Then you evaluate your algorithm, see how well it does, and either you're happy with it and you publish if you're an academic, or you try to implement the thing efficiently and sell it if you're not, or you're not so happy with it and you go back to one of those steps up above and try to figure out how you can improve it. So I'm claiming that document space lives here. It's in extracting the features and in selecting and projecting them into some space. So that's what document space is. So you can think of it as a mapping from documents, from a corpus, into some numerical quantities of some kind, some measurements, and then mapping those into the d-dimensional space. And I don't care if it's RD or something else, but I'm going to say RD. So here it is. You extract features, you select them, and you exploit them, and all along here you've got knowledge. You've got expert knowledge doing the extraction. You've got pattern recognition type knowledge in the selection and projection, and then pattern recognition type knowledge in the exploitation. And then there's feedback, right? You extract features, you look at them, you said, these aren't quite good enough, or they tell you they've got some correlation, let's try to decorrelate them. There's all kinds of things that go on that feed back, and they even feed back to the corpus. This is something you might not have thought about, but as a statistician, if I'm looking at the data and I see some outliers, I'm going to want to look at those outliers, decide if they really are junk. Perhaps I've got a document that got garbled and it doesn't actually have English in it, and I'm going to remove those outliers. Or I might decide that there are some articles in there that have nothing to do with the topic at hand and remove them. There's a bunch of different ways that this feedback could affect the actual corpus. Also, if we're talking about documents, we almost always have this idea that there's a human there, and it's the human driving this process, and the human has some idea of what it is they're actually looking at, and they're going to feed that back to the corpus and say, I like this group, I don't like that group, or I asked this question, but now I realize that I should have rephrased it, I should have asked a sub-question or a super-question. So there's going to be knowledge being fed back to the corpus. So, what are the lessons that we learn from pattern recognition? Don't extract more features than you need. The curse of dimensionality. This is almost always ignored in practice. You extract as many as you can think of. And then you rely on the next step to remove the ones that aren't necessary. Consult an expert. Also often ignored. Almost always you decide you are the expert. And I, from personal experience, I have to say that's the way it appears to me to be in document processing. Because I thought, hey, I can read, right? What can there be to this document? So I just jumped in and said, well, I can do document stuff too. And yeah, you go out and you read the papers and you learn what other people have done, but you think you know an awful lot about the problem to start with, and that may or may not actually be true, but that's the way it often happens. Also, operate in as low a dimensional space as you can, but don't go lower, and use the simplest model you can do, but don't go simpler than you have to. And I say iteration wins the race. This feedback and this repeated iterating and refining and changing the rules is the way to actually solve a lot of important problems. So you all know about the curse of dimensionality. This is one of its instantiations that I'm sure pretty much everybody here knows, but Think about a circle in a square or a soccer ball in a box. The ball takes up pretty much all the volume of the box, right? As you increase the dimensionality, the ratio of the volume of the sphere to the box goes to zero. In other words, all of the mass is away from the center. It's all in the corners and the edges. One way to think about this is imagine that you're going to generate random numbers in this hypercube, uniform random numbers. So you're going to do IID, say, uniform plus or minus 1. You're going to do DL. In order to be anywhere near the center, what do you have to have? The center's at 0. You have to pick every single one of those random numbers to be close to 0. If D is huge, that's not going to happen. One of them's going to be close to 1 or minus 1. And so you're guaranteed you're going to be out near one of these planes. Now, a pattern recognition, one that you might not have seen, this is in trunk 79, I think, in IEEE. You've got Gaussian data with known identity covariance. The only thing you don't know is the means. And the means are either plus 1, comma 1 over root 2 out to run over root d, or it's minus. Now, if you know the means, and all you're going to do is you're just going to say, well, what's the classifier? It's find out which mean you're closest to, and that's the class. So it's a two-class problem, and you just find out which mean you're closest to. If you know the means, the probability of error goes to 0. If you estimate the means, the probability of error goes to 1/2, a coin toss. But as d increases, you're adding information that helps you discriminate. After all, if you knew it, the error goes to 0. And the problem is that there is estimation error, and you're not adding enough extra information to counteract the error in estimating the extra parameters. And so just throwing more features in, even though they might be kind of good features, especially if they're correlated, in this case they're uncorrelated, but especially if they're correlated, you may not be adding enough information to counteract the fact that you've got more parameters. So what is document space? So it's a mapping. I said it's a mapping F, and it depends on this P, which is your problem, and K, which is knowledge, and it maps a corpus into RD. So that's sort of a first cut. Carrie always asks, should it be Euclidean space? And Carrie is always asking, how do we pick D? And that is a horrendously difficult problem. It's the model selection problem, and it's probably the best problem in statistics at the moment, at least in my view, which is how do you select models? I think it's one of the most important ones. So one of the keys is understanding the relationship between the problem and knowledge. Now, one way to do this is to punt and say, we're going to do this for every problem. So you give me a problem, and I'm going to say, okay, that problem says we do this. That's one way to do it. Maybe we can sort of put this all into one framework. I'd like to see somebody do that. So the blind men and the elephant. So you probably all know this story. A bunch of blind men come up upon an elephant, and one of them grabs the tail and says, oh, elephants are like a rope. And one grabs the trunk and says, elephants are like a snake. And one grabs the leg and say, elephants are like a tree. I guess that guy in the middle says elephants are like a wall or a boulder or something. So that's the story, and I'm going to show you, and I think you've seen already some examples of why document space is like that. But there's another perspective that you could have taken. Let's say the blind men, one of them was a rope maker, one of them was a snake handler, and one of them was a woodcutter. They come upon the elephant, and the rope maker feels around until he finds the tail and says, aha, I know about ropes. So I'm going to study the rope part of elephants. And somebody else comes along, the snake handler finds the trunk, etc. There's a lot of that in all kinds, in every problem that we have. You investigate the things you know. So if you're an information theorist, or certain classes of statisticians, you'll see word count histograms and start looking at n-grams and things like that, and you might start building more complicated probabilistic models on those. Speech recognition people, hidden Markov models and all kinds of other things. People that are interested in understanding natural language have all their own kinds of ideas. So there's both aspects of elephantness to document space. So it's clear that knowledge about the problem impacts on feature extraction. I mean, that you shouldn't pick random features. There's a whole area of study looking at random projections, but I think the space of features is so huge that just picking features at random is probably kind of weird. But obviously, in this area, there's all kinds of things you might think about. Do you need to stem or not? Should you remove stopper words or not? And I think of this as analogous to noise reduction in signal processing. How do we reduce the noise? There's misspellings. What do we do about that? Noise reduction. Then there's word count.
What is stemming?
Oh, that's where you take like talking, and I'll map them down to talk. There's word counts, there's various kinds of information, TF, IDF, all of these things, n-grams. If you're that community, you think those are the way to go, and there's certainly a lot to be said for a lot of the work that focuses on that area. And if you're more in the sentence structure arena, there's all, you know, how we saw one talk that showed that actually understanding the sentence structure is not a trivial thing. This is not a solved problem. And so there's a lot of knowledge that has to go into understanding how to do that. And then, do you need a thesaurus or not? And if you do need a thesaurus, if you need to be able to say these two words mean similar things, how on earth do you build such a thing and use it? Obviously, the problem impacts the exploitation. So whether you're doing classification or clustering, understanding, trying to understand what's in the document or comparing two documents, all of these things change what you do to the features, and they depend on the problem. So one simple first cut is that feature extraction depends on knowledge. The projection might depend on it depends on the problem, and it may depend on knowledge, but probably not, possibly not application-specific knowledge. I'm not sure about that. And the exploitation clearly depends on the problem. So my first thought was maybe document space is feature extraction from documents into some feature space. So what properties should this operation of extracting features and putting them into space should have? What properties should it have? So one thing that I claim it should have in this problem is corpus dependence. And I'm going to try to make this case. First off, what words or phrases or whatever kind of constructs you're looking at are important depend on the corpus you're using. And I'll give you some examples of that. And so if you change the corpus, I think you make a fundamental change to document space. In either interpretation, where you think of it as mapping to a space or whether you think of it as the space into which you map. So here's an example which may or may not be good enough for you, but I've got other ones. So here's a sentence that's from a particular corpus. You've seen this actually in the last talk, this corpus. But it's a Gabusi woman in New Guinea, decked out in her dance costume, sleeps on a wood pile during a male initiation ceremony. So what are the important words or phrases in this? Well, if you have absolutely no knowledge about the corpus except your knowledge of English, you might say, well, the really real content, the really important words that make this sentence different, that make this sentence an important sentence, are this word gabusi, that's very rare, New Guinea, dance costume, maybe male initiation ceremony. Those might be the things that you think are the really important words and phrases. You might argue woodpile, or maybe not. If I told you that this was a course about fashion, it would change your interpretation. Maybe those other words are also somewhat important still, but dance costume and ceremony are probably very important because that's what fashion is all about. As you can tell, I know a lot about fashion. It turns out, however, that it's in a document about the study of sleep that addresses the question of whether indigenous people have a different pattern of sleep than those of us that live in the hectic so-called modern world. And so, yes, the rest of the words are important, that's true, but sleeps is really important because that's sort of, if you're going to get a one-word description of this document, it's sleep. Okay? So,
Maybe if everything in the corpus is about sleep, then that's less informative.
Correct, yes, sleep. And that's exactly right, yes. So it turns out the reason that sleep is important is because the entire corpus isn't about sleep, but that there's a subcorpus that is about sleep.
Okay.
This document and a couple of other articles are about sleep studies.
Actually, even if the whole corpus were about sleep, it might be important to find sleep here because once you see the word sleep, you can say who's sleeping.
True,
that's
yes.
That's not always the same. Tracking those relationships might be particularly important if sleep is shot through the corpus.
Exactly, yes. And so that's right. So exactly what you mean by important is also going to change how you make these assessments. But it's clear that what corpus you're looking at has an effect on what words you consider to be important or how you address their relative importance. And there was a lot of discussion about the Wall Street Journal corpus in this, talking about whether this is, whether you can take any of the things that you learn from the Wall Street Journal and extend them to other corpora. And one of the issues there may very well be this corpus dependence. As soon as you add an entirely new corpus, you're actually changing how you should have thought about the Wall Street Journal had you known there were these other documents. So mapping documents in the document space requires extracting information from them. And at the lowest level, words and phrases, you might think, they correspond to information, and which words are, quote, important or have a lot of information depends on the corpus. As you point out, it also depends on the problem and on lots of other things too. So one property it should have is corpus dependent feature extraction. Now I'm not willing to leave it at that. I'm going to talk about conditioning, and I'm going to try to really pound in this corpus dependence to you. So there's conditioning on the problem, you know, what you do depends on the problem, and there's conditioning on the corpus. So I want to look a little bit more on this corpus-dependent feature extraction. So one thing you might do is remove unimportant words. Lots of people throw out stop words, right? Well, what are the stop words? Okay, if you're an expert, you know that certain words are stop words. And everybody removes things like and at and of and the, well, everybody in quotes. The example I like to give, which is a pretty hokey example, is the word and. Right? This is a word you throw out, but you don't throw it out if you've got a lot of documents about logic. Now, maybe you could fudge this and say, well, it's not going to appear as an and, it's going to appear as some kind of mathematical symbol, but it isn't. Or if you're talking about circuits, right, and gates and things. And then you fudge and say, well, it's going to be and gate. But and isn't necessarily a word that's useless. Yeah.
Even more, the earliest research on document classification was on authorship identification.
Yes.
Besides the so-called stop words that let you identify authorship.
Yes, that's an excellent point. Yeah. And so, how do you pick stop words? Yeah.
Of course, if you're doing parsing.
And if you're doing parsing, you can't throw anything out, right? Because they all tell you something about where you're at in the, what kind of thing you're at.
The is a very important word if you're trying to parse a sentence.
Yes. Right.
But not maybe if you're trying to analyze.
But not if you're, yeah. I can't come up with a good example of the if you're doing bag of words kinds of analysis to say that you would want to keep the. If you're doing, you know, unigram bag of words, maybe there is an example.
Well, identify the native language of the speaker.
Ooh, yes. That's a good one. Thank you. Okay, there is an example. So, one of the earlier talks, I guess it was Mauro's, had the Science News corpus in it. These were classified into 8 categories by a single individual with no guidance as to what he should do, except that he was given those 8 classes a priori. Okay, and you can see that there's a lot of problem here. I mean, one of the classes is life sciences and the other one is medicine. Why should a document have just one class? Well, he classified many documents as several classes. But at any rate, we're just going to take the first class he labeled. And I'm just going to take a subset of 50 of them. So we're going to map these into document space, and I'm going to map them into R2, just because it's really easy to visualize. And I'm just going to do mutual information, cosine dissimilarity, and then I'm going to map it into R2 with multidimensional scaling. Okay. I don't want to hear about this is a naive way to do things, right? Obviously, it's a naive thing to do, but it's a reasonable thing to do first cut. Okay, so there's mutual information and all of that. So here's the picture. And what you see is what you would hope to see. This is astronomy, and this is anthropology, behavior, medicine, life sciences. Up there is math. Yeah, up there is math, physics, and earth sciences. They do separate out kind of the way, they have kind of the relations that you would expect, that you want to see. Okay, now, what have I done? I've taken the mutual information, and I'm going to do this dot product to get the cosine dissimilarity, but I'm going to throw away any word that has a mutual information less than 0. I'm going to set it to 0. I'm going to threshold at 0. Why am I going to do that? Well, a word that has a negative mutual information is a word that is less common in the document than you would expect in the corpus. So first cut, you'd say that's not an interesting word. Okay? You can make an argument that perhaps ones with very high negative things are actually interesting. They're not there, and their lack of being there is interesting, but I'm not going to worry about that. So I thresholded at 0. What if I thresholded at something else? Thresholded at 2. Anything that has mutual information less than 2. See, if I do it at 0, I'm thinking, well, I'm going to get rid of all these stop words. But that says that you have to be less than you expect. But a stop word should be roughly what you expect. And so there should be kind of some noise level there. And so you should be a little above 0. And 2 is above 0. It's way above 0, but it's above 0. So let's look at these together. Has it made any difference how I threshold? And not no real difference. These are different, but it's not a major thing. It's pushed anthro and life a little bit closer together. It's kind of squeezed things up a little bit, but it hasn't made a huge difference. Okay. Now, those mutual informations depend on the corpus, and what words I throw out depend on the corpus when I threshold. But it hasn't made a big difference. So maybe you'd say, well, okay, yeah, it's corpus dependent, but it's not a big difference. But it certainly is. It certainly does make a difference. And this idea of thresholding by mutual information, that's probably not a bad idea for removing document-specific stop words quickly and easily. It may not be the one that you finally end up with, but it's not a bad first guess. What if I remove astronomy? I take out all of the astronomy documents. what happens? Let's look at these side by side. Well, what has happened is here's the original and here's the without astronomy. It's basically taken these two. It's now got room to spread them out, and they're almost orthogonal. Okay, now some of you might be thinking, well, the reason for this is that we're taking a different projection.
Excuse me, did you remove what actually is astronomy or what you estimated to be astronomy?
What was labeled as astronomy.
By the all-knowing label.
Yeah, by the
he wasn't all-knowing, but he did his best.
Yeah. He was as all-knowing as we've got. You could argue that what's happened is because this isn't here, we've just picked a different projection. So we've just looked at it from a different perspective, and so we've got that. There is some of that in this. That is, depending on what corpus you've got, if you're going to project down to some dimensional space, there's a different projection you're going to take. But there's also some of the words that are important have changed. What if we remove medicine? So I've removed medicine here. Let's look at those side by side. And
what color is the yellow one?
Yellow is medicine. And the reason for that is that medicine, life sciences, and behavior are all essentially the same vocabulary. They're very similar in their word counts. And so removing medicine is changing things. It's changing overall counts, but it's not really changing anything significantly. It's not making an important change. So feature selection depends on the corpus. And this simple, this is a rather trivial example, but I think it's pretty illustrative. A document will look different in the context of one corpus as compared with that of another. And this is very important when you think about a large corpus in which you're going to search and you're going to do iterative searches. So what you're going to do is you're going to allow the user to say things like, these aren't relevant, so throw away anything that looks like these. Now when you go back, if you're doing this recomputing of the features, which you may or may not be allowed to do due to time constraints, but if you are, you're going to have a different look into that corpus. Things are going to look differently. Now why isn't this just local dimensionality reduction? I implied that there is some of that in here. You are picking a different projection. So here's the A standard picture from manifold learning, where what you're doing is you're using local information here to produce a projection, and you're sort of unwinding this Swiss roll thing so that you observe that points that are along here really aren't close to points here in the true manifold. There is some of that in that example, but if I remove this little piece from this manifold, it doesn't change this projection at all, essentially at all. Okay? But it does change the features that I extract in our example, and so it does change the projection that you're going to get. So, far away changes affect local projections. And that's something that I had not seen in a lot of applications. I've seen it in the hyperspectral type things.
Is that a feature or a bug? We're claiming it's a feature. It's something to be exploited or something to be...
I don't know if it's to be exploited or to be avoided.
Okay.
But it's to be understood.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, it is to be understood. And it might be irrelevant in many problems because you can't recompute the features. You don't have time. Okay? So there may be examples where it doesn't apply, because since you're never going to recompute the features, it's never going to come up.
Dave?
Yeah.
You said that these pictures were constructed by multidimensional scaling.
Right, I
used
the
classical multi. What kind
of classical multidimensional
scaling. So basically, that's a technique that tries to do least squares fit on square distances,
right,
in essence. And so, you know, what it's going to try to do is try to do a good job of fitting the long range distances at the expense of the short range distances. So I think crucial to this example versus the other example is, in this example, you're removing something, the red, that's kind of a long way from
the
black and the green. And so instead of worrying about fitting where the red should go, now it's free to
move things around.
The black and green does.
Right.
Whereas when you remove the yellow, which is sort of, those are more short-range distances already, so you probably wouldn't expect it to have as much of it.
Yeah,
but that's, to some extent, that's the point, or that's part of the point, is that if the corpus, if you're going to try to embed something, you've got an embedding technique, and it has criteria, and if the corpus is such that the, you know, if you the corpus dependence, that is, if you consider a change in the corpus that is relevant to that criteria, that gives it more space or more freedom for whatever reason, it will have precisely the effect that.
Right. Yeah, that's important because it's not just the features have changed, but the actual embedding is going to change.
Right. I mean, there's several things conflated here.
Right.
It's difficult to tease them apart.
That's right. Yeah. And I don't have a good example that does tease them apart. Yeah.
You said you're not sure whether it's an advantage or disadvantage that faraway changes affect local projections, but for many applications, it's definitely a disadvantage of multidimensional scaling that it pays more attention to the big distances and the small distances, and that's one of the main motivations behind things like ISOMAP and LED.
Right.
And I think intuition says that that's true about document space also. If you're doing classification by nearest neighbor, for example, you want to get the nearest neighbors right, and you really don't care
about
getting the far neighbors in the right ranking. There's no truth of the matter about whether biology is more different from astronomy or psychology is more different from astronomy.
That's true, and I should say that when I process this particular corpus, I don't do this multidimensional scaling. I do something that is similar to what we saw earlier, where I fit a graph to the points and then do this something that's similar to the eigenspace projection. And one still sees some level of change. There is a dependence. And so it's not quite as, it's not as dramatic. And one thing I did not want to have to do is spend a lot of time. I wasn't sure where I would fit in here and what you would know. And so I didn't want to go through a whole long spiel about how that worked. Yeah.
Right, so I got confused by these comments regarding which metric you actually add on the corpus of documents, because I thought you thresholded the correlations pretty aggressively. So do you then compute geodesic distances, or you just literally describe
the
connections?
In this case, it's really just the cosine distances. It's just the dot product of those feature vectors.
Threshold.
They have been
thresholded.
The features have been thresholded. But the matrix hasn't been thresholded.
Okay, yeah, so I think the Michael's comment applies.
Yes, it does.
Here. Yeah.
Exactly, yes. Okay, now, obviously we all know that if you're doing a different problem, you're going to extract different features. So there's a couple of different things going on here. The one on the left is from a corpus, if you will, of images in which all the faces have been carefully registered to be centered, scaled to the same scale, and under controlled lighting. If you know that's what you're going to get, like passport photos, then there's one thing you might do. If you know you're going to get an uncontrolled, where you don't know where the face is and that kind of thing, you're going to do something different. If you can't even rely on getting a full face, you're going to do yet another thing. And the same thing is obviously true with documents. But it's more than that. What's the problem? Is it to recognize the person, to find the face, find words in the image, and my favorite, distinguish between student and professor? What do you think?
That's an important rule, John.
That is a real important rule. And there's a lot of other things you could do here, and obviously there's many examples in document space, or in documents that are analogous to this. Are you summarizing? Are you doing a query to find similar documents? Are you clustering the documents? There's all kinds of different problems that you could be approaching, and you'll get different features. So document space, I said, is this extraction of features. And this feature extraction thing is a very complex thing. It depends on a lot of things. It depends on, I'd like to take that K out of there and just say that's knowledge. I don't want to try to conflate that with knowledge about document space. I'd rather think about that as user input. It's the user's knowledge of exactly what they want out of the problem, rather than this knowledge of the problem domain. But it obviously depends on a lot of things. Is RD the right model? Well, psychologists have lots of examples of things. They've got examples of showing that A is greater than B, and B is greater than C, and C is greater than A, and they've got examples where the triangle inequality doesn't hold, and all kinds of things. So they all would say no. And then they turn around and say yes, because they all use PCA and multidimensional scaling, so they put everything into RD and proceed. And
they have no sense of humor either.
And they have no sense of humor. And we do it too, most of us. And so we probably shouldn't be laughing, but it's more fun to laugh. So lots of people have talked about, you know, the things they do as they are processing these documents, and they're computing things on the documents and stuff. And often it doesn't end up in Euclidean space. But a case can be made that while the initial space probably shouldn't be Euclidean space, there's a lot of tools for working in Euclidean space, so many of us want to put it there anyway. And the previous talk, Peter told us that anything can be Euclidean space up to within a certain
distortion.
And so maybe we shouldn't be worrying so much about whether it's Euclidean space or not. So back to the elephants. I think this user feedback is an extremely important thing in this arena, because one is very often looking at documents within the context of some goal from a user who is trying to learn something. And so if you do a search on Google and get back 100,000 documents, you, A, want them ranked nicely, but B, you would like to be able to say, okay, now I know something about what Google thinks if I type this in. I want to refine my query. I want to change what I'm looking for. And what would be really nice is if you'd say, okay, I have these documents. I know they're about elephants. But what I want is, how do you tell an African from an Asian? Or if you're doing swallows, an African from a European.
At work.
In text processing, there's a lot of ways you could think about this. So you go through some kind of process to find out what the important words are, or to find a subcorpus of interest, or we refine the knowledge of the problem, exactly what we want to do now that we know more about the corpus. And then we might revisit the whole feature extraction. So you might start with a bag of words approach, use this to figure out what the important words are and a subcorpus of interest in all of this, and then do some more complex or time-consuming analysis that focus on the subsets of the words or on words that are close to these important words. So document space, there should be some mechanism for putting this feedback into this formalism. So it depends on the problem, and feedback modifies the problem, as well as what features that you might want to extract. And notice I've grown the box a little bit to allow that we actually think that these, at least I think that these ideas of once you've got your features, now you want to embed them into your RD using one of these diffusion methods or multidimensional scaling or whatever other approach you're going to use, I'm kind of shoving that stuff in with document space, which agrees with some of the people that have made, that have talked here. So, and furthermore, some of the techniques in feature selection may also be corpus or problem specific that are document space specific. Now, I'd like to know something about what it means to add feedback in here. The other day, and some comment about somebody's talk, Terry said that the problem, he thinks about everything, see, some people. Some people like to frame everything as a hypothesis test. So you have the null hypothesis, there's nothing interesting, and the alternative hypothesis is that there is. That's the general alternative, and whatever test you're going to create for that has no power whatsoever. The problem is you don't know what the alternative should be to have a powerful test to get you back the thing you want. So one way to think about that is to ask the right question. So one of I forget who, but somebody asked, why don't you just answer the question? And there are, here's an example where I actually want a search engine to give me the answer. So I'm thinking in terms of, say, Google as a search engine, not the Google calculator or anything. If I type, what is the distance between San Diego and New York, into Google, what I want is a document that has the answer to that question in it. Okay? And perhaps that's not too much to ask for that question. But IPAM typed in the question, what is document space, into this search engine, and IPAM got back a lot of interesting answers, but it didn't get back a document that says document space is. I mean, the closest thing got was something about elephants.
Carrie's writing that later.
Yeah, we got Carrie.
Yeah, well, he hasn't written
right,
anything
closest
yet.
Right, the closest you got was something about elephants.
Yeah. So.
Well, we know where to look.
So the point of this is that not only is there often you don't know what the question that you really want to ask is, and you have to iterate to find out. But often there isn't an answer. Or if there is an answer, it's not in a single place. It's spread out in many places. And so what we don't know what the alternative should be. We don't know how to either take the question we ask and produce the question we should have asked, or take the answers we get and reject those in favor of the answer we want. So what is document space? I think the way to think about it now is that it's a collection of maps. It's not a map from a from that takes a document and puts it in RD. It's a collection of maps, and these maps go from a corpus and map that corpus into some space. And I don't have any idea how to think about this problem and knowledge question and the feedback, excuse me. I said one way to do this is to have the problem be sort of an index on these collections of maps, but I don't know if that's the right way to think about it. So it's a space of embeddings. It's not the space into which you embed. That's what I believe now. It has some properties, whether we like them or not. The features, many of the features we know how to extract are corpus dependent, and that's either a good thing or a bad thing, or indifferent. It depends on the problem. We need to have some method of refinement, and no doubt there's lots of other things. And this is not unlike office.